Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Warren Postman. I represent Appellate Lance Wood, and I'd like to try to reserve 2 minutes of time. By excluding Mr. Wood from services at the prison chapel, appellees imposed a hoop-and bar on one form of Mr. Wood's religious practice. But the district court never analyzed that burden under strict scrutiny as required by the law, because it concluded that Wood had no remedy. Wood had no claim for injunctive relief because after more than 6 months of excluding Wood from the chapel, appellees lifted that burden so that the injunctive claim was moot. But the district court also concluded that Wood had no damages claim because appellees had not received any federal funds directly, and that relief didn't cover that. It didn't give Wood a damages claim in those circumstances. That conclusion was wrong in both a statutory and a constitutional matter. As a statutory matter, I think there's two key provisions of RLUIPA that make crystal clear there's a damages claim in these circumstances.
Well, just a moment. You say it's wrong as a statutory matter and a constitutional matter, but it's not wrong as a factual matter, is it? It is true that these defendants did not receive any federal funds.
That's right, Your Honor.
And do we know whether the prison received any federal funds? On this record?
On this record, I think the court would have to take judicial notice of the materials we cited in our reply brief and a footnote. It was not really litigated in the district court in part because appellees, my understanding, never claimed that RLUIPA didn't apply. RLUIPA, that's right, RLUIPA only applies where a program receives federal funds. And they could have said, RLUIPA doesn't apply at all in this case, because we don't receive federal funds. My understanding is that every state receives federal funds for prisons, and that it's difficult to just take judicial notice of that. So the statutory question I was referring to was, if a prison takes funds, but the individual officers do not themselves get it, can a plaintiff whose rights are violated under RLUIPA sue the officers for in an individual capacity for damages? And I think there's two key provisions in RLUIPA that make clear that as a statutory matter, RLUIPA was intended to cover that.
Well, but reading, aren't you asking us to find differently than our sister circuits found?
I am, Your Honor. And
frankly, the Tenth Circuit reviewed all the circuits' analysis and went through them, and then after going through them, they said there can be no damages.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that the
circuits... And not only did the Tenth Circuit do it, but they reviewed all the other circuits' analysis and determined that they didn't want to part from it.
Right. I'm happy to explain sort of how, if you would ask me, I think those circuits took a wrong turn.
I understand.
That is your job.
And I think they followed each other. So it was I believe, the 11th Circuit first in 2007, and then the next two cases came really quickly. It cited the 11th Circuit without much more analysis, and it was off to the races. But I think they did take a wrong turn. And if I could, I'd start with the statutory.
You want us to get out there on our own as we normally do on our
only when you're right.
We think we're always right.
We aren't the ultimate decider of that.
But I think the key language to focus on in the statute is the definition of government first, where after saying the government includes any state, county, department, etc., and any officers, which I think means officers in their official capacity, I think, it then says government also includes, quote, any other person acting under a state law. And then, in creating a cause of action, RLUIPA says that a plaintiff has a cause of action for, quote, appropriate relief. Now, as this court made clear in the City of Yuma, where a federal statute creates a right to appropriate relief and there's no defendant with sovereign immunity, the presumption is that appropriate relief includes damages. In fact, that's the first sort of relief you can get, and injunctive relief is extraordinary. And so I think the City of Yuma makes that very clear. The other key point is that...
Well, but the City of Yuma, really, there wasn't any sovereign immunity issue there, was there?
No, there wasn't. Municipalities don't get
sovereign. So really, the City of Yuma is not directly on point to us.
To the contrary, Your Honor, there's no sovereign immunity for appellees either. So I think the City of Yuma is analogous to appellees here, whereas in contrast, in Sossamon, the Supreme Court said there were no damages.
There is a sovereign immunity question here, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Appellees are not entitled to sovereign immunity as individuals.
Oh, it has to be individual.
Yeah, and that's the distinction that I was going through with the second point, which is if the phrase any other person acting under a color of state law didn't give plaintiffs a right to damages, it would do nothing in the statute. Because a plaintiff can always sue an officer in their official capacity for injunction. That's covered by the definition of officer under government.
But you'd agree that the individuals are not party to the contracts between the federal and local government?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that goes at most to the constitutional permissibility of subjecting them to liability. I think, and this can be analyzed slightly different ways, but I think that for me, the simplest way to ask is, if you read the statute by itself, did Congress want to apply a damages remedy here? And then you can go to the next question of, okay, if it did that and subjected someone who didn't get federal funds to get damages, is that within their power, Congress's power under the spending clause? Now, on the first question, I think in addition to City of Yuma, which says appropriate relief includes damages, it's very compelling that the phrase any other person acting under a color of state law would not give a plaintiff anything if it didn't give them a right to damages, because they can already get injunctive relief against an officer. So on the spending clause purpose issue, I would just note that the district court appeared to think that, as you alluded to, Judge Smith, if a defendant hadn't received federal funds, it was beyond the reach of the spending clause.
I don't think the district court was way out to lunch. That's what I was trying to emphasize. There's been no other circuit who's analyzed this who's gone where you wanted to go.
That's right, Your Honor. The district court pointed to all that circuit authority from other circuits, but I think the reason they're wrong is sovereign. And the U.S. Supreme Court said very clearly that Congress can not only subject the defendant to damages, but criminal penalties when they receive no federal funds. And the reason for that is that all the cases the other circuits cited about the spending clause being limited to the nature of a contract, those were cases where the defendant was a state and had sovereign immunity, and the argument was that they were directly liable under the spending clause. But Congress is not limited to regulating under the spending clause. It also has the necessary and proper clause, and the two work together. The court made this very explicit in Sully. It's at page 605 of their opinion, it explains how there's the two forms of regulation. And so it could regulate someone who wasn't a third party. And the last point I would note is that if Congress cannot regulate third parties in this way, then there's a major hole in the purpose of RLUIPA. RLUIPA was intended to prevent
I don't think this is a big hole in RLUIPA. We're the ones who are supposed to fill it. We just read it.
No, that
is. Congress didn't make it the way it ought to be. They need to go back and do something about it.
That's
not
right.
That they do that and compromise on a daily basis.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean we should be filling it.
I agree, Your Honor. I have only 2 minutes left. I just made one point, which is the analysis of whether it's permissible under the necessary and proper clause turns on whether it's appropriate for Congress to effectuate the purposes of its spending. And if Congress is left powerless to stop the recipients of federal funds from discriminating against people on the basis of their religious practice, then it is relevant.
You don't question that Congress could have provided a remedy if they
I think, and that's why I split it into statutory and constitutional terms. I think not only could they have, they clearly did in RLUIPA. And my point then is that yes, they do have the power under the Constitution to do that.
Let me ask you a slightly different question, and I'll give you some time for a thought. The district court did undertake an analysis under the free exercise clause. How do you view that analysis as being different from the analysis that would have been required of the district court under the RLUIPA?
It's quite different, Your Honor. Under the free exercise clause, under Employment Division B, any mutually applicable rule is immune to challenge on the basis of free exercise.
Yes, no, I understand that. I guess my question, and I wasn't probably clear, the district court really made some pretty specific findings in terms of reaching the free exercise clause. And some of those findings, factually, as far as talking about the legitimate purpose, overlap with some of the findings that may be necessary under RLUIPA. So my question to you, and I think I know what your answer is there any way on this record to reach the merits of the RLUIPA claim based on the district court's finding on the free exercise clause
I understand the question, Your Honor. No, there's no way to reach the merits, and there's a couple reasons. One, although the district court opinion is not crystal clear, I read it as applying the Barnett v. Santoni standard to the First Amendment claim, which means that when he said there wasn't enough evidence, it wasn't the right standard. He wasn't saying there's enough evidence to include that they needlessly burdened the religious exercise. What he was saying is, well, there wasn't enough evidence to prove there was no basis, objectively, that some other officials couldn't have also burdened the religious exercise. But beyond that, RLUIPA does not just require a showing that they did it for a legitimate reason. It requires a showing that that reason is compelling. And the court in Solano County Jail, I think, makes very clear that you can't just point to general interest in security. You have to show what would have happened had they let him attend group religious services. What really would have happened?
Well, in this case, the district court found that, in fact, there was disruption that was going to occur. There was displacing other people from their religious exercise, allegedly.
Well, that was only the third memo, I believe, but even with regard to that, I think that Solano County Jail has a great discussion about those things too, that you can't just say that. You have to actually prove it. And there was certainly reason, and this was summary judgment, of course, and you can construe everything in favor of the plaintiff. There was plenty of evidence to the contrary. There were 10 affidavits from nurses and guards saying food was never a problem. And then the final point is that they also have to show these restricted means, which doesn't come into the retaliation analysis. They have to show that they couldn't have, for example, just had him supervised when he attended religious services, or put restrictions on the chaplain, Peterson. And they never went through that analysis. I think it's too fact-bound and too disputed to do at this stage.
Thank you, Nancy. Our questions are taking over time, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Michael Elia, and with me is Brady Ball, co-counsel. We represent the Idaho Department of Corrections defendants in this case. We appreciate the opportunity to present this case before you here in Moscow. This case began in 2003 with incidents that involved Mr. Wood and untoward relationship with correctional officers and more female. In 2004, Mr. Wood filed a lawsuit involving that case, and that case was pending when this lawsuit was filed in 2007, claiming retaliation against the Idaho Department of Corrections defendants. We're now in 2013, and the clock continues to tick, but we're here to try and resolve this case and get some final resolution.
Plaintiff in this case. What could you straighten me out as to what institution he was in when the episode that gave rise to the first lawsuit took place, and then when he was chained, when he was moved?
Sure, Judge. Mr. Wood was housed at the Orfino facility in the period including 2003. That's just 40 miles down the road from here. Mm-hmm. During that time period, he allegedly had untoward relationship with correctional officers, and when that was discovered, he was moved to the facility in Boise, ISCI there. So the rest of the events in this case occurred while he was housed at ISCI.
So he filed the first suit when he was at ISCI?
He did, yes. The facts that have led to the allegations made in this case are essentially conduct by Department of Corrections employees who are trying to determine, A, what happened with their own employees, and now I'm talking about Chaplain Les Peterson, and why Mr. Peterson decided to try and contact one of these ladies on behalf of Mr. Wood, allegedly without Mr. Wood's knowledge, and we don't know that one way or another. And then A year later, there were allegations and concerns about Mr. Wood's conduct in the religion facility in the chapel itself. And that event, those events led to the restriction on religion as alleged by plaintiff. What's important in our view of the case is that Mr. Wood was never restricted from his practice of religion. Not a single time, and it's cited over and over again, it was banned, but the facts don't support any of that.
Well, that's kind of why I asked your colleague Amy to start the questions. Can we reach that issue on this record? The district court didn't reach the merits of the legal claim. It did reach the merits of the free exercise claim, finding any facts, but there's a different analysis under Aluba, so explain to me why you think that we, rather than the district court, could resolve that claim on the merits.
Judge, I believe you can, based on the record. I think the record is very well developed with affidavits filed by both sides, well discussed by the district court under the First Amendment analysis. Why I think this court can decide under Aluba, if we get there, if it is applicable, is that the first issue on Aluba is whether there's substantial burden to his practice of religion. And I think this court has previously decided that in looking at cases in preparation coming here today. And the Hartman, the California case, has cited 707F3rd 1114, where the individual had a practice involving a Wiccan belief, and his claim was that there was no Wiccan chaplain. There were other chaplains of other denominations, but no Wiccan chaplain. There was a volunteer chaplain that come once a month. There was also chaplains of other denominations, and he claimed in his pleadings that his practices had been limited. The court, looking at more soldier under 12b6 motion, said, you can't even state a claim. Your practice has not been so changed that you cannot practice your Wiccan beliefs. It's been limited.
Do you think the facts are undisputed on that point? On the first point.
In this case, yes. I think they're absolutely undisputed.
So your argument would be there may be disputed facts on whether or not the punishment was appropriate, what happened, whether Wood should have been excluded at all, but there are no facts in dispute as to the burden placed on him.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would agree that if, in fact, he were prohibited from practice, from going to any services for 6 months, that would be a burden?
If that were in fact the case,
yeah.
I think it would be a burden. If that were essential to his practice of his religion.
Right. But your position is that he wasn't barred from services.
He was not. In fact, the two times he was limited, it was in coordination with Mr. Wood to set specific times. And our understanding, that's so that the correctional officers who were there at the facility would know that he could be there, despite the fact that there was concern about him being around the chapel area and around his work. He was banned from his work for a period of time. That is also undisputed, but there's no constitutional right to that.
So, go ahead.
You haven't answered counsel's suggestion that Centro Familiar Cristiano Buenos Nuevos, I'm from Idaho, so I don't say it right, versus Yuma, is controlling in this matter?
I'm glad you took a shot at that pronunciation, but our answer is twofold. Number one, that in the City of Yuma case, what I'll call it, the court and Judge Thompson, I think you were on that case.
That's true. And I didn't pronounce it any better.
The court didn't have the issue of RLUIPA, the applicability of RLUIPA, whether it applied to the municipality before it. It just wasn't, at least in the opinion, and as far as I can tell in the briefing. The second answer to that is that a municipality is different than a state entity. There is no sovereign immunity to it.
But doesn't that cut against you in this case?
I think it could cut against Judge. Although I would put the state actors in a different category. And I know 1983 allows that individual action against state actors, but under RLUIPA, you know, we're dealing with the spending clause there and the authority for that. And so in order for those state actors to be subject to the provisions of RLUIPA at higher scrutiny, they need to be able to accept the contract with the federal government. They've never had that opportunity. So there's a little blending of
it seems kind of like Yuma, city of Yuma, and the state actors are similar. I mean, it seems like that if you read Yuma and you really read what it says, that there's not much difference between the city of Yuma and the state actors. We're not talking about the state itself. We're not talking about somebody who took the contract funds, which Yuma had not done. So I'm wondering, I mean, when I read Yuma, I said, I was wondering what you're going to say when he said the controlling case.
The back to the first answer, which is it wasn't at issue in the case, as far as I can tell. But I think there is a good rationale for treating the municipality different. I don't know if the record supported the municipality had received federal funds, or whether that was, again, an issue in the case. But there is no dispute on this record that Deputy Warden Yorty, McEckern, Nelson, that those individuals did not.
Well, why after Savory or Savory, depending on how you pronounce it? Does that make any difference? I mean, the Supreme Court changed a little bit of the spending clause jurisprudence in that, I think, by widening it, saying you really don't need that level of proof.
Just Thomas, under Savory, as we've read that case, the Supreme Court, Congress passed legislation under necessary and proper clause to enforce the provisions of making sure that federal funds don't get squirreled away in bribe attacks. And so they passed a criminal law to ensure that that's not going to happen. And there are different authorities. So the fact that the individual in Savory was subject to that legislation, in our view, doesn't make an instant connection back to the spending clause.
No, the spending clause is part of the case, you'll grant that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And Justice Souter discussed the spending clause and I think took a little bit different tack than the other circuits who, prior to that case, had considered these RLUIPA funds. So, I mean, to me, Savory changed things. Now, the Third Circuit case is after Savory, but everybody else's, all the other cases from the circuits were before that case.
Judge, I see my time is up.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I would just conclude by asking the court to follow the six other sister circuits that have analyzed this case throughout the progression of the Supreme Court's views on RLUIPA and its limitations and its efforts to maintain its constitutionality by limiting its use and not imposing monetary damages against these individual defendants.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just make a couple quick points about the substantial burden issue. I think bringing these Solano County jails speaks very specifically to the way the analysis should go. As I understand my appellee's argument in their brief, they're arguing that because or if Wood could have practiced religion in some other way, it's not a substantial burden if he was limited to a couple days a week. Solano County Jail rejects that. If that's a case where the plaintiff was prevented from group religious practice and the defendant said he could still practice his religion in another way. And the court said, no, that's too broad. Religious practice, you look to whether there's a burden on the facet of religious practice. Now, substantial burden, and Ward-Solar discussed this, that comes up where rather than banning a religious practice, the prison burdens it. In Ward-Solar, the prison said, well, you can leave your facial hair, but you're going to be subject to other restrictive conditions. And the question is, do those conditions burden and substantial enough? But where you're banning...
Well, partially banned.
I'm sorry?
Partially banned.
Well, certainly the last memo
on its face, bans him from any group of religious practice, which is directly on point with Solano County Jail.
Would you agree that the facts are undisputed as to this prong of the argument? In other words, what burdens were placed on him?
Not exactly as I heard my opposing counsel describe it. I do believe it's undisputed, but in Wood's favor. I think it's undisputed that for the first week he was not allowed to perform at all. Now, appellees say that was a misunderstanding. He begs to differ, and there's some evidence to suggest it wasn't a misunderstanding. I would note that if it were really a misunderstanding, it would have been very easy in the second memo to say, oh, no, religious practice is fine. It's not what the second memo said. It says you can go for 2 hours each week, and everything else is excluded.
Yeah, I guess my take on it was that there were factual disputes about the justification and a lot of other material in the record, but there's not much dispute as to what actually happened in terms of the restrictions he was placed under. Do you agree with that?
I think that's right. I'm just a little hesitant because my opposing counsel may have a different view, but I think it's clear that he was banned for a week, limited for the next memo, and then banned from all group practice for the last week.
And then the last memo, when you say the last memo, you're talking one about from Ludlow? Or as to Ludlow?
I believe it was Ludlow, the February 1st, 2007 memo.
Okay, I'm just trying to make sure that I'm following you. It's second memo and last memo, so that I got them down here, because I've listed them not second and last. I got them down as the date.
As I understand it, as the district court described it, that February 1st memo was on page the ER 14.
All right. I just wanted to make sure I had your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument. The case is here will be submitted for decision. Well presented, the briefing and the arguments today. I appreciate you coming out from D.C.
Were you participating under our pro bono program? Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Express our appreciation for that.
Thank you.
The case is here will be submitted, and we'll be preparing for Dixon come forward, and students who need to leave.